Good morning. I am Larry Hamel, 4143, and with me in the case is Velissa Soukaras, who is at counsel's table. In the notice of appeal and in the briefs, we have set forth six issues on appeal. While they are discrete issues, they nonetheless fall within two general categories. The first category is the inadequacy of the damages that were awarded to the plaintiffs in this case. Those damages are entirely inconsistent with binding law. The second general area is the refusal of the trial court to both award us attorney's fees as a prevailing party at trial and also refusal to award us costs as a prevailing party at trial. I'd like to address the first issue, and that is the damages that were awarded in this case. As you know from reading the briefs, one of the major claims in this case was a breach of duty of loyalty by an employee, actually two employees, who left the practice of medicine with the plaintiff and entered into competition. The jury found in favor of the plaintiffs on all claims having to do with tort, including punitive damages, exemplary damages for willful and wanton conduct by the defendants. The law, as we've laid out in our briefs, and principally Jet Courier versus Muley, states that where you have a breach of duty such as was found by the jury here, the jury must award damages in an amount calculated at the rate of compensation during the period of the breach of the duty of loyalty. In this case, we have raised the issue of the adequacy of the instruction on that point. The trial court refused to give the instruction, which we believe is justified and called for under the Jet Courier case, and that is that if you have an employee who is in breach of his duty of loyalty and breach of his fiduciary duty, that you must award as damages the compensation that was paid both on a monthly and a quarterly bonus basis.
Mr. Hamel, can I ask for some clarification on this issue? In reading Jet Courier, it seems to say that you forfeit a month's pay for a period of disloyalty. But is the month's pay relative to the month in which the compensation is paid, or is it the following month? In other words, what are we talking about when we say the disloyalty occurs? What then should be awarded, in your view?
If the disloyalty occurs in the month of June and the employee receives $1,000 as compensation for services supposedly performed during the month of June, that's the measure of damages.
Entire amount forfeits.
It is. And there's quite a bit of time spent in the brief by the appellees in this case about apportioning. I think they're misreading the Jet Courier case when they talk about apportionment. And clearly in that case, we have precisely the same circumstances here that we had that they had in Jet Courier. And that is that the employee was paid a monthly compensation and a quarterly bonus. And in the clear instructions by the court, by the Supreme Court, in sending this case back to the trial court, the Jet Courier case back to the trial court, they said, Mr. Muley is not entitled to any compensation for any month or any quarter in which he was in breach of his duties.
Let me ask this: if there's a breach in March of the year, then the employee is not supposed to receive the March compensation; has to forfeit that back.
That's correct.
All right. What happens to April, May, and June?
Well, if they continue in their breach, which was the case here, then each month in which they are in breach, they must pay that compensation.
Did the jury make any findings, or were they asked to make any findings about whether these breaches were continuing or isolated?
The jury was not given an interrogatory saying during what period of time was there a breach. This is why we believe that the appropriate remedy here is to remand the case for a new trial on that issue. Not on liability, of course, because that's a fixed occurrence now. But somebody has to determine what the period of time was for the default, the breach of the duty of loyalty, that is in the province of the jury. The jury found that there was a breach here. They did not establish the date upon that breach, and then they awarded $1 in damages, which is clearly inconsistent with MULI.
I'm sorry, go ahead, sir.
Excuse me, Mr. Hamill, but under the instruction that the court gave, the jury could have found for the amount of compensation paid to those doctors during the period of the disloyalty.
They could have.
Yes.
Yes.
And that your instruction just amplifies in more detail about monthly and quarterly.
That's correct.
But yes, the language of the instruction given to the jury allowed them to do so if they elect, if they did chose.
It did not allow them to do so. It directed them to do so, yeah, which is, of course, what the law is. Once they find a breach of duty, then they are compelled. And that's the problem here. I mean, the argument that there was perhaps a de minimis breach. You know, there's case law that we've cited, and it's very clear under Colorado law that you don't have a de minimis breach. You don't have a 75% breach. You've got either a zero breach or a 100% breach, and there's no apportionment among degrees of breach. And so they found a degree of breach. The judge, the trial judge, says, well, maybe they found a de minimis or technical breach. Well, that's not the law in Colorado. And the law in Colorado is also that they cannot just find $1 nominal damages. The appellees argue that we should have said, should have objected because the instruction didn't say you cannot find nominal damages. I think that's surplusage to say the least. When you're directed by the instructions that you must award compensation in that period of time, then that's the duty of the jury. It's not a question of discretion. It's not a question of evaluating damage evidence. The damage evidence in this case was never in conflict whatsoever. Liability certainly was in conflict. I mean, it talks about how
pardon me, Mr. Hamill, if I may. The trial court, in its order denying the JNOV, stated that the calculation of damages was in contest. And so that raises a question for me about the absence of the trial record in this case. Is the issue of the period that you're talking about, is that one of fact?
Yes.
If it is one of fact, then and we apparently have from the trial court some indication that the calculation of damages was disputed, then how do we know without the record that the period was not in dispute?
The issue of dispute, the issue that would be in dispute in a new trial would be what period of time was involved. The evidence was disputed as to what occurred at one point in time or another. There is no question, however, that there was a breach of duty. The only question is what the damage is, sir.
I understand that, Mr. Hamill. What I'm trying to get to here is this. As far as whether or not we should send this back and whether the original instruction that was actually given was erroneous, my concern is this. If we don't know whether there was a fight over he's paid monthly, he's paid by piece, he's paid semi-annually, he's paid annually, if we cannot tell those things from the record, then it becomes difficult for us, first of all, to evaluate was your proposed addition to the instruction consistent with the evidence or not? And if there was a dispute, it sounds to me like your proposed addition was just a theory of the case instruction as opposed to a proper instruction of law. Because if it can be disputed, and there was a dispute, then why would that go into the instruction?
There was no dispute that they were paid on a monthly basis and that they were entitled, theoretically under their contract, to a quarterly bonus. There is an exhibit which shows how much they were paid each and every month and how much the quarterly bonus was.
Is that in the record?
It is in the record.
And what is the exhibit?
It's
about a total of $800,000. Is my memory right?
Mr. Karras tells me it's SR 693 to 695.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamill, can I ask you a question on the on the issue of the breaches that you're talking about? Could it be that the jury found a breach occurred for 1 hour at the close of the July period and said, we're going to award $1 damages for that?
It could be that the jury thought that there was a 1 hour breach. That's certainly possible. I think it's highly unlikely, but it is possible. Even assuming that's the case, I think under Jet Courier versus Mulai, the damage measurement is still the 1 month's compensation plus the quarterly bonus for that period of time.
But given the way the instruction reads, and even I think, I'm not sure whether your tendered instruction says this, but the instruction given says an employee is not entitled to compensation for services performed during the period he engaged in activities constituting a breach. I'm a little confused about the, quote, the period, because they could say, well, the period was only an hour.
But, Your Honor, respectfully, under the Jet Courier case, the Supreme Court held that if there is a breach, it doesn't make any difference whether it's 1 hour or a year. It is the period of that breach that fixes the compensation. And so if we assume that there was a 1 hour breach, then under Jet Courier, the proper measure of damages is the period, the compensation was calculated on a monthly basis and a quarterly basis. To the extent that there was a breach within a month, then that month's compensation is forfeited, must be disgorged, as must the bonus, which incorporates that period of time.
So it's your view that under either the instruction as given or the one that you tendered, there's only one measure of damages for breach, and that's the month or the quarter in which the breach occurred.
Which is precisely what Jet Courier says. I also point out that in our brief, we discussed the Pelsu case. There's an error in our brief. The Pelsu case was, in fact, decided after Jet Courier versus Mulai. And if you take a look at that Pelsu case, there's certainly nothing inconsistent, although the appellees argue that there is an inconsistency with Mulai and Pelsu. There is not. In Pelsu, it was a question of how many months of compensation, together with director's fees, should be forfeited or disgorged by the person who was in breach of his employment duty of loyalty. The court held there that you measure the damages by the monthly compensation that he got for every month that he was in breach. So the Pelsu case, even though the argument of the appellees tries to distinguish that case, is entirely consistent with Jet Courier versus Mulai. The other cases that they cite are cases outside of Colorado where they say that, well, you don't take a month because the guy was paid on a month. You don't take that as the measure of compensation. You take only if he was in breach for 3 days, you allocate 3 days out of his month's compensation. That is simply not the law in Colorado. I'd like to turn to the second issue, and that is the failure to award us costs and attorney's fees. If the word prevail means anything at all, we prevailed on every aspect of this case. There is a fee-shifting agreement under the employment contract, which says that the person who prevails at trial on a breach of contract case is entitled to, shall be awarded, attorney's fees, costs, and expenses. And, of course, we have the cost statute and cost rule in Colorado that also talks about the prevailing party. We prevailed on every issue in this case, either by directed verdict or by jury verdict, including the claims for willful conduct. I'll get it out here. And so the idea that we did not somehow or another prevail in this case is absurd. And it's equally absurd because there are cases which we have cited in our brief that say the fact that we only got nominal damages does not control.
Spencer versus Aurora.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the law is clear in Colorado. And in fact, the appellees don't even address that issue in their brief. They keep talking about mixed results cases. This was not a mixed result case. We won hands down on everything. If there are no questions, I'd like to preserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Eric Hall, bar number 32028. I'm here on behalf of Drs. Weinstein and Zenos. Again, Your Honor, this case was a multiple claim case. The plaintiffs brought six claims against my clients, seeking over $750,000 in damages. We, in turn, brought three counterclaims against the plaintiffs, also asking for hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was an eight-day trial to a jury. After that trial, the jury awarded $13 in nominal damages to the plaintiffs. They awarded my clients nothing. The jury thought, and the trial court properly reflected, that it was a nominal breach. It was a de minimis breach. Neither side prevailed in this case. I agree with the plaintiffs that there are two issues on appeal, the disloyalty claim issue and which side prevailed, whether the trial court was proper in ruling that neither side prevailed. I'll take the disloyalty claim first. Plaintiffs spend quite a lot of time just now talking about Jet Courier versus Mulai and what the rule out of Jet Courier is. It is simply not the case that Jet Courier says that you need to use this rounding up approach such that if there's a day's worth breach, that then somehow the proper measure of damages is to round up to the entire month or the entire quarter. That's not what Jet Courier says. It's not what the cases that Jet Courier relies on says. It's not what any case that has followed Jet Courier says. First, let me talk about Jet Courier. On page 499 is where this discussion starts. At the beginning of page 499, the Supreme Court says the general rule. And the general rule is that a defendant who's been found disloyal must disgorge compensation during the period of disloyalty. The Supreme Court at that time cites a Tenth Circuit case, Wilshire Oil from 1969. That Tenth Circuit case says specifically found a particular period of disloyalty. In Wilshire Oil, it was a trial to the court. The court found that the person was disloyal from May 31st to December 31st. That was the period of disloyalty, and therefore, in the Wilshire Oil case, the defendant had to disgorge the compensation earned over that period. There was no rounding up to monthly pay periods or quarterly pay periods.
Well, even assuming that's correct, looking at the summary that the Supreme Court used to apply the principles, it says, if the trial court concludes Mulai breached his duty, then he would be entitled to compensation for services performed where no breach occurred or for which compensation is apportioned. But under this approach, he would not be entitled to any salary or compensation for any month during which he engaged in acts breaching his duty of loyalty. So even assuming the Tenth Circuit rule is a little different, it sounds to me like the Supreme Court is going beyond that.
Well, no, Your Honor, I disagree, and this is why. Because if you look at the two paragraphs prior to that paragraph that you were just reading, Your Honor, those two paragraphs talk at some length about the amount of disgorgement is the amount during the period of disloyalty, and then they're rebutting Mulai's argument, which was I should be entitled to my compensation because I properly perform my duties. And the court says, no, you shouldn't. During the period of your disloyalty, you must disgorge all that compensation. But then the next paragraph, right before the paragraph, Your Honor, you just referred to, the Supreme Court goes on to say, but you are entitled to compensation for any time when you were not disloyal. For any time you were not disloyal, you are entitled to compensation. And then it goes on to the paragraph that you just referred to, and that sentence that you read that plaintiffs rest their entire case on, that one sentence, is talking about not entitled to compensation for any month during which he engaged in acts breaching his duty of loyalty, during the month. So if Mulai was disloyal for a month, then he must disgorge compensation for that entire month. But not if he was disloyal for a week in that month, must you round up to disgorge an entire month of salary. Again, the T.A. Pelsu case that, again, plaintiffs just referred to, which came, again, 2 years after Jet Courier and cites Jet Courier, adopts the same sort of approach that Jet Courier endorses, which is you find the actual period of disloyalty. In T.A. Pelsu, the trial court, again, another case to the bench, found that the person was disloyal for 2 years, a month, and 2 days. And then therefore had the defendant disgorge over that period. It didn't round up to salary, monthly pay periods or quarterly pay periods. And such a rule would make no sense because then the amount of disgorgement would depend arbitrarily on what the person's pay period was. Let's take two identically situated defendants, one being paid by months and quarters and one being paid every other week, biweekly. Well, the first defendant, for the exact same conduct of being disloyal for a week, according to plaintiff's theory, is going to have to disgorge a month and a quarter's worth of compensation. But the second defendant did the exact same thing, a week worth of disloyalty, is only going to have to disgorge 2 weeks of compensation because of the arbitrary background fact that he happened to get paid every 2 weeks. That doesn't make any sense. No court has ever adopted the rule that plaintiffs propose.
Mr. Hall, pardon me for interrupting, but let's, just for a second, let's set that aside. I want to ask about the record or absence of record here.
Okay.
We don't have a record of the trial before us.
You don't have a trial transcript? Yes, sir.
Right. So, counsel for the appellant has indicated that there was no dispute over the period of reimbursement, which was a monthly payment, quarterly bonus. Is that so?
No, Your Honor, that is not so. Again, for a disloyalty claim, three things need to occur. The jury needs to find disloyalty, the jury needs to find the period over which, and the jury needs to find how much the person was being paid. What they continue to refer to is the third item, how much the defendants were paid. Sure, that was not contested, but the period of disloyalty was hotly contested. And, Your Honor, as you correctly referred to, the August 20th, the second order that the trial court issued, goes on at length and says specifically the damages evidence was hotly contested. The trial court goes on for some paragraphs because it was addressing the exact arguments the plaintiffs were making below and making here, with saying the damages evidence wasn't contested. The trial court said, no, it was hotly contested. And I'll give you an example. They claimed at trial that the disloyalty period went from March to July. They argued that. The jury clearly didn't believe it. We argued there wasn't disloyalty at all, but also if there was disloyalty, it sure didn't start back in March. And there was evidence about when it might have started in May, might have started 2 days before my client's practice actually opened in July. There was a letter that plaintiffs spent a whole lot of time on from two other employee physicians where they said they were going to come join my client's practice, and they said, oh, this proves disloyalty as well. So the jury could have found, oh, there was just disloyalty for the last 2 days. It was hotly contested as to how long my clients were disloyal, if they were disloyal at all. The trial court recorded that. The fact that plaintiffs didn't put the trial transcript in the record prohibits you all from reviewing whether in fact there was a disagreement about how long the disloyalty occurred. And I can tell you there was a hot disagreement about how long the disloyalty occurred. And then according to the rules and the cases that we cited, this court must not only respect the jury's verdict, it must also presume that the trial court was correct, because the plaintiffs didn't put the trial transcript in the record for you all to review. I want to go back to this rule that they're proposing. This rule would be groundbreaking. It would be earth-shaking. Why? Because it would be the first claim I can find in Colorado where nominal damages would never be appropriate. The rule they're suggesting, and Mr. Hamill just mentioned it to you all, they believe that a disloyalty claim, you can never award nominal damages. I looked in my trial brief, in my answer brief, I cited various cases to you, both from Colorado and from all over the country, case after case where it said nominal damages are appropriate. In preparation for this oral argument, I went back and I did more research. I found 27 different cases in Colorado, all of which, for 27 different claims, say nominal damages are appropriate. This would be the first claim I'm aware of where, according to Colorado law, according to them, nominal damages are not appropriate. What's going to happen is plaintiffs are going to say, what a bonanza. I'm going to bring disloyalty claims every chance I can, because all I need to prove, according to plaintiffs, is a peppercorn of disloyalty, a day of disloyalty, an hour of disloyalty, and I get the whole pay period. You got to round up to the whole pay period. Plaintiffs are going to look for not only any defendants that might have been disloyal, but the ones with the longest pay periods, the ones that actually got annual bonuses. Because going to plaintiffs, if you just get a peppercorn of disloyalty on that defendant, he has to disgorge his whole annual bonus. That doesn't make any sense. That's not justice. That's nonsense. And it's not what Jet Courier says. Let me say another reason why, to get back into the text of Jet Courier. Again, I suggested that on page 500, in the paragraph immediately prior, the Colorado Supreme Court says you do get compensation for any periods you were not disloyal. What case do they cite there? They cite a Second Circuit case, 1985, called Musico. In Musico, the court there examines New York law. They come up with the same rule that the Colorado Supreme Court adopted, which is you must forfeit your compensation during the period of disloyalty. They discuss explicitly an 1886 case from New York that used to that did, back in 1886, adopt this rounding up approach that plaintiffs now cite. The Musico case expressly rejected the rounding up approach, saying that's not the law in New York anymore. The Colorado Supreme Court, at this exact place in Jet Curry versus Mulai, favorably cites Musico for the proposition, again, that you only have to disgorge the period you were disloyal. So this sentence that they rely on must be understood to mean Mulai, if he were disloyal for an entire month, must disgorge his entire month's salary. If he were disloyal for an entire quarter, he must disgorge his entire quarter's salary. But not if you were disloyal for just an hour, you must round up and have him disgorged the entire month or the entire quarter. That's not what Jet Courier says. And again, no case in Colorado or elsewhere has followed that approach. Every formulation of the amount of damages for Jet Courier claims says defendant must disgorge the amount of compensation during the period of disloyalty.
So Hall, let me ask you about the Moore case then, because the Moore case deals with a real estate commission.
Yes.
And the entire commission was forfeited there, even though there was no demonstrable harm to the plaintiff.
No, Your Honor, just a slight modification there. In Moore, the plaintiff was arguing a similar rounding up theory to what plaintiffs suggest here, saying that the commission, which I think was $140,000, the entire $140,000 should be forfeited, when in fact the defendant had only earned half that commission. So he only earned half of it, roughly $70,000. The plaintiff in that case was saying the defendant must disgorge the entire $140,000.
Well, I know the court rejected that
court
view,
rejected
but the $70,000, they did require disgorgement of the entire amount, just for the period in which the defendant failed to inform the plaintiff of the offer.
No, I understand that, Your Honor, but that's because that was a task approach, right? So there's time approach, there's task approach, and that Jet Curry describes this expressly. It says under the apportionment approach, if you have a task item like selling a piece of properties on commission, you're not keeping track of your hours, then you must disgorge the entire amount for the disloyalty that occurred. In that case, the amount that that person actually received, but under, again, a task approach. But that's different from the Mulai case or our case, where the people were paid under a time approach.
I'm struggling with that because it seems to me that you've got a time issue in both cases. If Mulai stands for the proposition that you determine the period of disloyalty, regardless of when it is, you know, 5 minutes, 1 minute, an hour, whatever, and that's the rule, then Moore would have said, how much time was it that you failed to disclose? How long was this breach that you failed to disclose? As opposed to simply taking the approach of saying, your failure to disclose means you get nothing.
Again, you know, I think Jet Courier says expressly under what it calls the apportionment approach, you apportion the amount of disgorgement to the disloyalty at issue. In Moore, which again, it's a breach of fiduciary duty, and so it doesn't cite Jet Curry, so it's slightly different. They're saying he has to disgorge the entire amount that he was paid for that task. Right? There were no hours. Nobody could figure out how long it was spent. But in the Mulai context or our context, it doesn't make sense to say you have to round up to the closest pay period. That's not what Jet Curry says.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Hall. In Jet Courier, the court writes, apportioned compensation is that paid to an agent or employee that is allocated to certain periods of time. I stopped the sentence there. If we have somebody who is paid by the month, how can we determine anything more about a period of time? I suppose I could understand your argument if there was an hourly payment, but if the payment is month or by a bonus, a quarterly bonus, how can we determine the certain period of time?
Just like in Wilshire Oil or in Pelsu, in those cases the trial courts found the person was disloyal for these discrete periods of time, and then you just take the pro rata amount of how much the person was paid. If he was paid annually, you just take, okay, and he was disloyal, take T.A. Pelsu for 2 years, 1 month, and 2 days. Okay, if he was paid an annual salary of whatever and got paid by the month, well then the pro rata amount for that is X, and he has to disgorge that amount. I'd like to... Oh, I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
With respect to the Mulai case, please look at the paragraph preceding the one that you quoted, Judge Casebolt. It talks about Mr. Mulai, had he not breached his duty of loyalty, he would have been entitled to compensation rendered during periods from which no breach occurred and for which compensation is apportioned in his employment agreement. They go on to the next paragraph and it talks about Mulai's employment contract provided his salaries to be paid on a monthly basis and that quarterly and a quarterly bonus, applying the principles discussed above, which are the ones we just talked about, including this apportionment. They then go on to say if he didn't, was not in breach in a month, he gets his monthly compensation. If he is in breach during a month, he gets no part of his monthly compensation. Pelsu is no different. Pelsu did not apportion. Pelsu allocated to the and required disgorgement of every month's compensation where the man was in breach of his duty of loyalty. And the logic is, I mean, we talked about, counsel talked about how this is going to open the floodgates to litigation. We're not trying to give a bonus to the employer. What we're trying to do is penalize appropriately the person who's in breach of his duty of employment loyalty. And so the switching it back to the employer saying, well, you only should be able to get for 1 hour's breach of loyalty, you only be able to get 1 hour's worth of compensation. The whole concept of breach of loyalty is much broader than just this temporal. Finally, with respect to Moore, the decision in Moore of splitting that commission was based upon concepts of unjust enrichment. It was not based upon the idea of duty of loyalty. I mean, the obligation was there, but the claim was an unjust enrichment claim. It was not a breach of duty of loyalty claim. So that's why the court divided that up, saying, well, if Moore didn't get $140,000, then they were not unjustly enriched by $140,000. I'm sorry, my time is up, unless there are other questions. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.